I'm Daniel Levine, and this is the Bio Report. In January 2023, AstraZeneca agreed to acquire Cincor Pharma, the SynRx cardiorenal disease therapy subsidiary, for $1.3 billion. The deal included a potential additional $500 million milestone payment. The price represented a 121% premium to Cincor's market value at the time and could grow to more than a 200% premium if the milestone is met. The sale represented validation of SynRx's portfolio approach to build multiple biotech companies supported with a dedicated funding mechanism. We spoke to John Isaacson, founder and CEO of SynRx, about the company's portfolio approach, how its business model allows it to accelerate the development of needed medicines, and its efforts to develop new obesity therapies. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
We're going to talk about obesity, SynRx, and its efforts to develop drugs that can work synergistically with GLP-1 drugs. Before we do that, though, I wanted to start with SynRx's business model. It describes itself as a mosaic of biotechnology companies. Others may think of it as a hub-and-spoke model or taking a portfolio approach. For listeners not familiar with SynRx, can you describe the business model?
We describe ourselves as a portfolio biotech company, which basically is very similar to others who use the terminology hub and spoke. Essentially, SynRx acts as a holding company, a kind of umbrella, and then we look for compounds to license or acquire, and we form companies around those compounds, which become our subsidiary or portfolio companies. And within SynRx, we have a very experienced team of drug developers who take those compounds that are within these companies and move them forward and develop them with the view to ultimately exiting. We don't intend SynRx, that is, to become a pharma company and commercialize any of the compounds within our portfolio companies. So they need to find a new home. But we are very efficient in taking these compounds, moving them forward. We have a very close relationship with a CRO by the name of Medpace. We sit in the Medpace building, and we leverage a lot of the interactions that we can access through that relationship with Medpace.
And do you think of yourself as a drug developer or more as an investor managing a portfolio of companies?
Well, it's a little bit of both. But the real value that we believe this model gives us is that we can share resources across companies in a way that other companies that have one drug and they have to develop a full team of very often very high paid individuals. We, on the other hand, can actually share the resources, especially in the early phases of a drug's evolution. You know, down the road when you've got lots of studies and you're contemplating a phase 3 program, you need a dedicated team. But in the early stages, one doesn't need that. And so by sharing resources, we are able to do things at a much lower cost than most other biotech companies. And so, as you well know, the statistics of what happens to biotechs as they move forward, the vast majority are discontinued. So we can really kind of have multiple shots at goal, make for a much more efficient process. And we have a team of people who have been working together for a fairly long time and are very adept at doing this, both in terms of the due diligence that we do as to decide which compounds to bring into the portfolio, and then once they're there, actually moving them across the development path.
Beyond the efficiency of the model, do you see other advantages?
Well, the thing, obviously we are a kind of, there's a collaboration between the investment and everybody that is an employee of SynRx has an incentive to make the totality valuable. And if one of the drugs succeed, everybody benefits. So there's a kind of an alignment of incentives between the kind of the investment side and the execution side. And in the way it's worked for us has made for a very efficient process with a very kind of, low turnover rate among staff who really all kind of are pulling in the same direction.
One of the challenges for young biotechs is often making the decision to kill a program. I'm wondering if what the decision process is like at SynRx, and does this structure allow you to be more dispassionate about decision making on go and no go?
I think that in terms of, I said multiple shots at goal, I think that the way we have kind of put this together, we are very, very disciplined, both on the kind of decision to take something into the portfolio and when it's time to actually, stop. And I, having been part of a CRO, I was at Medpace from its earliest days. And ran the medical and regulatory side and watched how pharma and biotech think. A lot of that experience has come into how we think about the drugs that we are developing. I also was part of Big Pharma and watched how the dynamics keep drugs going for much longer than they should. And there's always some kind of explanation. We are kind of very, very, you use the word dispassionate. I think that's a good way of describing it. But we need to get out when it's time to get out and not keep the drug going because somebody has some hidden interest in why it has to be kept alive.
In January, SynRx spin out SynCor, which develops therapies for hypertension and other cardiorenal diseases, reached an agreement to be acquired with AstraZeneca for up to $1.8 billion. What did this deal do for SynRx, and was it validating to your approach?
No, I think it absolutely was validating. We licensed a drug from Roche at a time when a lot of big pharma companies were getting out of cardiovascular disease. There was this kind of notion that a lot of the diseases within that cardiovascular space has already been addressed. A lot of it is generic, and there isn't really room for new drugs. And Roche was one of those companies. They exited the cardiovascular space, actually got rid of a number of employees, and left behind a very valuable set of drugs, of which I was very familiar with, had worked with Roche at Medpace for a long time. And I became very interested in that drug, and we went through a fairly competitive process to license the drug from Roche. And then we put our team to work and we took this drug from Roche, and they had done some early kind of single ascending dose studies, but then we took it into multiple phase one studies and started the phase two program that had interim interim analyses done. And, you know, the pre-money on the Series A round was in the range of around $5 million. Within a year and a half, when we had some of those interim analyses and had put this drug into a kind of, you know, proof of concept study in patients who were kind of resistant to antihypertensive drugs and showed the benefit. By that stage, the crossover round, the Series B, was at a pre-money of $150 million, and that was in a year and a half duration. And then obviously the rest is kind of, it went IPO. We spun the actual company out. I stepped down as the CEO of that company. We brought in a CEO who had a tremendous amount of experience in taking companies public. And because we had real data to attract a very good CEO, and the company was spun out and became a fully fledged independent company, and then was sold to AstraZeneca. As it turns out, we had done a lot of work with AstraZeneca when it was still kind of part of SynRx, and so they just continued that as an independent company that was at that time a public company.
One of the big stories for the industry last year was the success of the GLP-1 class of obesity drugs. What makes these drugs so compelling?
You know, I think that the GLPs started their career as drugs for diabetes. And that kind of, you know, patients were with diabetes were losing weight. And they asked the obvious question, the folks that had the GLP-1s, what happens if we give this to obese individuals who are not diabetic, and demonstrated very convincingly that there was profound weight loss in those individuals. At the time that they were developing this drug for diabetes and in the early days of its development for weight loss, there was a notion in the pharmaceutical industry that a lot of the prior drugs that had worked in that space, their commercial success was very, very poor. And so what the GLP-1s have done is really very, very convincingly made the case that treating obesity as a medical condition makes absolute sense. We are treating so many conditions associated with obesity, whether it's cardiovascular involving hypertension and heart attacks and obviously diabetes. All of that are very intimately associated with being overweight. Furthermore, even conditions like cancer, there's such a profound connection between various types of cancer and obesity that it was so obvious to anybody thinking about it that if you treated the primary problem, the weight gain, you would manage to actually have a real impact in those associated comorbidities. And as I say, the perception of the failure on the commercial side was really driven by the FDA, who were not fans of giving obesity drugs indication. They almost viewed that as almost cosmetic treatments. The payers were not particularly forthcoming. And so it kind of got buried. And the GLP-1s were really came on and made the case that it made sense to treat the obesity per se as a medical condition. And they have gone on to demonstrate that through the weight loss that you achieve with the GLP-1, you actually address those comorbidities that are associated with it. And now it seems so obvious, but it really took a long while for it to make the case. And obviously, the payers who are still reluctant, and that is a big problem that remains, getting patients these drugs, the ones that deserve it, and getting reimbursed for it. The FDA has definitely made a significant adjustment and will continue, we hope, to make the necessary adjustments that they need to get the proper selection of obesity drugs approved. One thing I'll say about GLP-1s, just before I conclude on this question, is that they have, and I think a lot of it has to do with the prior history that both Novo Nordisk and Lilly had in the insulin space. And so the delivery, the subcutaneous delivery of the GLP-1s has really been tremendously well accepted. You know, if you look at all the studies that are done as to why patients discontinue taking GLP-1s, and we can talk about that in a second, but the subcutaneous delivery is really not one of the primary reasons for patients to discontinue. So they not only have established obesity as a condition warranting treatment, but they've also been able to deliver a biologic, a subcutaneous delivery, and get it really accepted by a very wide spectrum of the population.
How big a market are we talking about?
You know, this is an interesting question because we know what the market was in 2022. It was around about 2 to 2.5 billion. It increased to about 4.5 billion in 2023. And now you look at all the projections of where this is going, and it's all over the show. From, 20 billion in 2030, I've seen as high as 70 billion by 2030. So obviously, there is and all of the analysts and pundits here have a different view, but clearly this is a growing market.
Your subsidiary, Sinfina, is developing a portfolio of peptide therapies. Two of these are in development as monotherapies for obesity, and two are dual agonists that are in development to be used in combination with GLP-1 therapies. The lead candidate is SIN-109. What is that?
Let me start off by saying, GLP-1s clearly dominate the obesity space. There were a few drugs, some of which I was involved in, that preceded GLP-1s, but clearly the GLP-1s are now corner the vast majority of the obesity market. But just like what happened in hypertension and hyperlipidemia and diabetes, the use of combination products that provide different modalities of action of different drugs often provide a better result than an individual drug given on its own at very high doses. And that is our belief that that is where the obesity space is heading. The next generation of drugs targeting obesity will look to the GLP-1s and all that they can deliver, but try to address some of the gaps, some of the problems that have emerged, and ultimately provide patients with a better quality of weight loss that is, you've got to stay on this for a long time. And so that patients can stay on it, achieve what we need to achieve in terms of weight loss, have acceptable tolerability, and have a better product. And that really is the underlying spirit behind Synthena. And it actually was the way in which Johnson and Johnson felt about the obesity space when they were developing it. And they decided to get out of the metabolic space for corporate reasons. We are not privy to that. But one thing I do know, big pharma companies, make all sorts of decisions on priorities, some of which make sense, others are only known to the company itself. You know, we look at Roche and they got out of cardiovascular disease. We took a drug for hypertension. Roche now have acquired a drug for hypertension that they just took. So they're back in this space. And that happens with companies all the time. And so it's not surprising for us that Johnson & Johnson, just before obesity took off, actually decided to deprioritize that. And we were the lucky recipients of that. And the portfolio that we licensed from Johnson & Johnson involved, as you point out, four different compounds. The 109 compound, that is the leading compound, is a GDF15 analog. The other monotherapy, we call it 110, that is a PYY analog. And then what Johnson & Johnson did was they covalently attached each of these monotherapies to a GLP-1 such that they can be given, the combination that is, can be given in a single injection. And that's essentially what we licensed from them and how we have approached the development of these four compounds.
Well, how does 109 work?
109 is a GDF15, and the explanation of how it works is a little complex, and I'm going to try and put it to you in a somewhat simplistic way. But when you take a GLP-1, or for that matter, when you go on a low-calorie diet, your energy intake goes down. The GLP-1s work by decreasing your appetite centrally. They also have an effect peripherally. That's why they have an effect on actual your appetite and your energy intake, but also have an effect in kind of curtailing diabetic elements. But when you reduce your energy intake, the body actually responds, and there's a metabolic adaption that occurs where a whole variety of counter-regulatory mechanisms kick in. And what that results in is a reduction in your basal metabolic rate, as well as a variety of metabolic issues that tell the body, you know, you're starving. You better reduce your energy expenditure. Don't expend so much energy because you're not getting the energy from the diet. And whether that's based on a set point whereby people have over years developed a set point at their overweight state, and now when you reduce that with reduction in energy intake, the body doesn't like it, and there's a kind of saying out there that obesity protects obesity. And the way it does it is by making these metabolic adaptions. And what that does, and part of the way in which it does that, and that's what's one of the problems with the GLP-1s that has got a lot of attention, is your lean mass goes down. So for up to 30 to 40% of the weight reduction is not because of your fat mass going down, but your muscle, the bone, the various kind of metabolically active organs, even and water content that makes up the lean mass, that goes down significantly. And with that, you have all of these metabolic adaptions, including a reduction in metabolic rate. And what that does is it allows the body to operate on less calories. And that actually, over time, is one of the causes of the weight regain that occurs, both while you're still on the GLP-1s and when you stop taking the GLP-1s. Now, GDF15, which is a drug that actually works centrally, also has an appetite-reducing element, But more importantly, it acts to maintain energy expenditure. And it does that by maintaining lean mass. And it works centrally to actually activate the sympathetic nervous system. So you get beta-adrenergic stimulation, and in the muscles, you get elevations in noradrenaline levels, and that drives increase actual what we call thermogenesis. It is a metabolic activity within the muscle that increases the actual temperature, very similar to what happens when you exercise, and that tends to maintain the energy expenditure. So when you give the GDF15 together with the GLP-1, you do a number of things. You maintain energy expenditure as opposed to losing energy expenditure. You maintain lean mass. You actually do change a lot of the metabolic parameters, and you kind of move from a more carbohydrate oxidation to more fatty acid oxidation. And so it produces a kind of an attempt at a higher quality of weight loss when given together. Now, obviously, we have to prove that. There's been a lot of work done with GDF15 by some of the big pharma companies who discontinued the GDF15 because they were looking at the total weight reduction. And the weight reduction is not nearly as good as you see with the GLP-1. We, on the other hand, and J&J, when that preceded us, were not thinking of this drug to be given as opposed to a GLP-1 because it doesn't produce the total weight reduction, but to be used in combination with the GLP-1, perhaps at lower doses, maybe improving tolerability. But when you think about what they were testing when they looked at just weight loss, if you get fat mass going down, but lean mass actually staying the same or going up, your total weight that you see on the scale is going to be a combination of those two factors. So we don't need to see as much weight loss on the scale as you see with the GLP-1, because we are looking to use the GDF15 as a combination with the GLP-1. Let's get the weight loss from that, but let's maintain energy expenditure and let's maintain lean mass by having the GDF15 on board.
What's the development path forward?
What we are doing now, we have just finished the multiple ascending dose study. And we're in the process of analyzing the data. We have pretty good data from the mouse studies with MRI and the non-human primates with DEXA that was done by J&J, which demonstrated exactly what I've just described, a reduction in fat mass, a maintenance of lean mass, in some of the high doses, even an increase in lean mass. And we are getting suggestions of that from our very small multiple ascending dose study. So we are now planning the next phase 2A study, which is a combination of the GDF15 with semaglutide. And there will be different combinations, some of them low dose, based on what I described in the explanation, and some of them taking the dose of both up to the maximum tolerated doses. But we will be looking at energy expenditure, basal metabolic rate, as well as imaging, both on the DEXA side and the MRI side in these patients in that study. And each of these, the combinations, there will be a monotherapy with semaglutide on its own and our drug, the GDF15, on its own, which will be a good way of comparator to the combination of the two.
And are you doing all of this on your own, or are you working in collaboration with any of the GLP-1 producers?
No, the GLP-1 that we have in the combination, those combinations that we got from Johnson and Johnson, that is a proprietary GLP-1 that Johnson and Johnson had. It's none of the ones that are currently on the market. So what we intend to do is to develop each of these monotherapies, the GDF15 and the PYY analog, and get them approved in of themselves as monotherapies. They then can be used together with other GLP-1s that are already on the market. And when that paradigm of combinations of these drugs are accepted in the marketplace, we have that follow-on with the combination given as a single injection. And that's a somewhat delayed kind of development. As you can well imagine, the manufacturing of two biologics in one injection is something that it's going to take a little longer to develop.
And how far will existing cash take you, and what's the plan for raising additional capital?
We are in the process at the moment. We have put in about $40 million from SynRx into this Synthena company. So SynRx owns Synthena to 100%, and we are now doing a Series B raise and talking to multiple venture groups. A raise of $60 million into Series B.
John Isaacson, founder and CEO of SynRx. John, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thanks, Daniel. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening. The Bio Report is a production of the Levine Media Group. To automatically download this podcast each week, subscribe to our RSS feed or through iTunes or other podcast manager. To join our mailing list, go to levinemediagroup.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to drop us a line or are interested in sponsoring this podcast, send email to danny@levinemediagroup.com. Special thanks to Jonah Levine, who composed our theme music, and the Jonah Levine Collective, which performs it.